KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Is this my first time here now after the war?
This is the first time you're coming back?
Yes.
A glimpse into the shattered capital city of Sudan after 2 years of conflict.
Today is Tuesday, May 6th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour, the Supreme Court is allowing the Trump administration to begin its ban on transgender military service members.
Also, Veterans Affairs Secretary Doug Collins testified on Capitol Hill today for the first time since his confirmation.
Senators questioned him about massive staff cuts at his department.
I will not let you sit here and scare my veterans and scare my employees.
And the axolotl is an endangered amphibian.
But a new study says they could make a real comeback.
Not only are they evading predators, but they're also successfully hunting and finding prey in the wild.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. As President Donald Trump's trade war continues, the U.S. and China have not been talking. However, the Treasury Department now confirms top U.S. officials are expected to meet with the Chinese delegation this weekend in Switzerland. Trade Secretary Scott Bessent and U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer will sit down with their Chinese counterparts. Bessent, in an interview with Fox News, said the U.S. and China need to de-escalate before they can move ahead.
We have shared interest that this isn't sustainable. As I said before, especially on the Chinese side, and, you know, 145%, 125% is the equivalent of an embargo. We don't want to decouple. What we want is fair trade.
Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, while numerous economists have said the U.S. tariffs are a drag on economic growth, Bessent told lawmakers on Capitol Hill today the measures will ultimately lead to other countries lowering their trade barriers. Republicans are considering plans to sell off some federal public lands to build housing and also to pay for President Trump's domestic agenda. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports that's reigniting a decades-old controversy in the West.
Environmentalists have seized on proposed plans spelled out in leaked federal documents. Tracy Stone Manning, who ran the Federal Bureau of Land Management under President Biden, says it's a blueprint for a larger push to transfer the land to states or private industry.
Congress is considering selling off our public lands to pay for tax cuts for the wealthy.
Casey Hammond was acting director of the BLM during the first Trump administration.
Well, I'd love to see this blueprint that they're always talking about, because they've been alleging wholesale transfer of public lands for decades now.
Hammond says it's only a push for transferring small amounts of land, part of a shift away from what he says was a disastrous conservation-only strategy under Biden. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Boise.
Elon Musk company SpaceX may soon be launching more rockets from its base in South Texas. As NPR's Jeff Bromfeld explains, the company was just given a major environmental approval by the Federal Aviation Administration.
SpaceX is developing a massive rocket in Texas. It's called Starship. It's the largest spacecraft ever built, and Musk hopes it will someday carry people to Mars. But before it can, the company needs to complete a lot of test launches. It had been limited to just 5 launches a year, but a new ruling from the FAA would allow that number to jump to 25 launches. Local environmental groups have been concerned about the impact those extra launches would have on surrounding wetlands, but the FAA concluded they would not cause significant harm. The additional launches won't be coming soon. Starship exploded during its last 2 test flights, scattering debris across the Caribbean. SpaceX is still working to fix the root cause of those failures. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 389 points. The Nasdaq fell 154 points. This is NPR. A federal judge in Rhode Island has issued a preliminary injunction blocking President Trump's attempts to dismantle the Institute of Museum and Library Services. NPR's Andrew Limbong explains that's the agency that offers federal funding to museums and libraries across the country.
In March, President Trump issued an executive order stating the IMLS and 6 other government entities be, quote, eliminated to the maximum extent consistent with applicable law. In response, 21 states sued the Trump administration, and now District Court Judge John J. McConnell has given the states a legal win in the form of a preliminary injunction. His order states that the EO, quote, disregards the fundamental constitutional role of each of the branches of our federal government. The IMLS is the main source of federal funding for libraries. Its budget last year was about $250 million, which helps libraries pay for staff, interlibrary loan services, and even basic needs like internet access. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
The U.S. Supreme Court says it's allowing the Trump administration to enforce its ban on transgender people in the military while legal challenges in the case play out. Court acting today in the dispute over a policy that disqualifies transgender individuals from serving in the military. Since beginning his term in January, Trump has sought to aggressively roll back transgender rights. Trump, in an executive order, claimed that sexual identity of transgender troops conflicts with the values of the military and is harmful to readiness. Crude oil futures prices rose today amid signs of higher demand from Europe and China. Crude up nearly 3.5% to settle at $59.09 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington, where the U.S. Supreme Court today allowed the Trump administration to begin carrying out its ban on transgender military service members, at least for now. To explain, NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg is here in the studio. Hi, Nina.
Hi there, Ari.
President Trump has been trying to ban transgender troops in the military since his first term in office. What's the difference between then and now?
Well, in the first term, he partially succeeded, but the ban was reversed by President Biden, only to be put back in place by Trump after he took office for a second term. This new order mimics the Trump order from the first administration, and it appears to strengthen it as well, because it bars transgender individuals from enlisting, and it also allows for the discharging of active duty transgender service members as well.
So what did the Supreme Court do today?
In a one-paragraph unsigned order, the justices revived the ban, which had been temporarily blocked by the lower courts. The court's three liberals, Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson, noted their dissents and would have barred the administration from putting the ban in place while the case continues to be litigated in the lower courts. And so the case now goes back to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals for the Trump policy to be reviewed.
There's been so much legal ping-ponging in this case, going as far back as 2016 when the Obama administration first allowed openly trans individuals to serve in the military. Explain how this current policy is different.
The Obama policy was reversed by Trump in 2017, followed by new rules issued by then Defense Secretary James Mattis. The Mattis rules actually allowed exceptions to the ban for active service members previously diagnosed with gender dysphoria. But the new policy, the Trump 2 policy, is significantly tougher because it bars from the military anyone with gender dysphoria, a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, and that would be basically all transgender individuals.
So where does this leave us now?
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals will take a whack at deciding the issue, and that decision can be appealed to the Supreme Court, though the ban is likely to remain in place during the appellate process.
And so, assuming that this case ultimately does reach the Supreme Court again later, what are the chances that the justices will ultimately rule against the Trump transgender ban in the military?
Probably slim to none. The fact that is that the Supreme Court, even on a temporary basis, has allowed the Trump administration to proceed with carrying out the ban. And that's a pretty strong indicator that the administration is very likely to prevail in the long run.
How many transgender individuals are in the military right now under the policy that allowed them to enlist and serve?
The Obama policy was reversed by Trump in 2017, followed by new rules issued by then Defense Secretary James Mattis. The Mattis rules allowed exceptions to the ban for active service members previously diagnosed with gender dysphoria. But the new policy, the Trump 2 policy, is significantly tougher because it bars from the military anyone with a gender dysphoria diagnosis. And while that might not be everyone, it's most trans individuals.
And what can you tell us about the plaintiffs behind this challenge?
The challenge to the ban was brought by a group of current and aspiring transgender service members, including lead plaintiff Emily Schilling, a Navy pilot who's flown more than 60 combat missions over her nearly two decades of military service. Ruling in their favor, Judge Benjamin Settle in Washington State, who was a George W. Bush appointee, concluded that the government's classification of gender dysphoria as a disqualifying medical condition was essentially a ruse motivated by hostility towards transgender people.
We've described how long a legal journey this has been. When do you expect it might finally conclude?
Well, I would think that the case will be back at the Supreme Court next term for a final ruling, regardless of who wins in the Ninth Circuit.
That is NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Thank you, Nina.
Thank you, Ari.
Sudan's capital, Khartoum, was once a vibrant city of more than 6 million people before civil war exploded on its streets and consumed the country for more than 2 years. The paramilitary Rapid Support Forces took over the city in the early weeks of fighting. They were battling their former allies, the Sudanese Armed Forces, in a war that has caused humanitarian catastrophe and the worst famine in decades. Then, about a month ago, Khartoum was recaptured by the Sudanese army. But the city is a shell of its former self, as NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu reports.
Against the backdrop of destruction, sounds of life and revival in Khartoum. Groups of children ride their bikes through eerie, deserted streets. They race and skid on the sandy concrete, riding past empty buildings and storefronts left in ruins. A stand selling Sudanese tea and coffee has reopened for the first time in 2 years. The owner lays out plastic chairs and serves the first few customers. And nearby, staff at a bakery sweep glass from the storefront, shattered by gunfire. There's a shortage of water and no electricity. But then the generator bursts into life, and the bakery reopens again. These are the scenes emerging from a city hollowed out by the war. It's more than a month since Khartoum was recaptured by the Sudanese army after 2 years of brutal occupation by the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Just a few years ago, this was one of Africa's most populous cities, with bougainvillea draped over sand-colored walls, restaurants lining the riverbanks, the city filled with monuments and architecture rooted in various eras of Sudan's history. But much of Khartoum is a scene of destruction. We walk across broken concrete and glass at the centuries-old presidential palace occupied by the RSF until the last days of the battle for Khartoum. The halls battered and broken, its facade burnt to a matchstick. Almost nothing has been spared, not even the country's treasures. Sudan's National Museum held rich records of the country's ancient civilization.
After you. Okay, welcome. Welcome.
At the museum, I met Musa El-Fador, an archaeological researcher working here for 27 years. As we walk through the gates, the scale of the damage is overwhelming.
It is so bad.
The gardens are charred black, the museum walls blown open. Towering statues of Nubian kings at the entrance are punctured by bullet holes, the arms hacked off. Inside, the cabinets are empty, the floors covered in debris. Precious evidence of Sudan's ancient history was ransacked. The museum held close to 100,000 artifacts that spanned more than 4,500 years. It stored mummies and artifacts from the Islamic, Christian, and Meroitic eras.
These halls are small antiquities. It belonged to the Marowetic period at that time.
But most of it was looted by the RSF. Even electric cables were ripped from the walls and stripped for copper.
Everywhere they dig and take it. And also all the air conditioning, they take the machine inside and take it.
In several offices, fighters even defecated in the room. Most of the artifacts that they didn't take with them, they burnt or destroyed. Only the library was left mostly intact. As we drive through Khartoum, with music playing from the car stereo, the sheer scale of the theft and damage unfolds at every turn. It feels like the RSF swarmed through the capital city like locusts through a field. They stripped almost every building and home they controlled of anything of value. And the same brutality inflicted on the city was also inflicted on its people. The RSF turned schools, hospitals, and homes into detention centers. Untold numbers of people were tortured and killed, as told through the survivors, like 24-year-old Munir Jalabi at a military hospital in Khartoum. His body is skeletal, his bones bulging through his skin. He was arrested by the RSF over a year ago while he was buying food at a market. Jalabi was kept in a cell packed with people who were whipped and beaten. They were only fed a small glass of lentils and water each day, if at all. The bodies of those who died would be left in the cell for days. Jalabi's mother, Afaf Abubakar, is sitting by his side. She said she didn't recognize her son when she first saw him here 3 weeks ago. She thought he'd died until she got the call that her son was at the hospital. We continue our journey across Khartoum through areas kicking back into life. And every so often we stop when our driver or our producer, Amar Awad, spots family or friends they've lost touch with during the war. Awad greets his old school friend, who refused to leave Khartoum. He says the community suffered under RSF occupation and that they're thankful to be alive. A major cleanup operation is now underway. Teams of tractors clear the rubble and debris across the city, street after street. Yet their work only scratches the surface. It will take several years and billions of dollars to rebuild Khartoum, but not everything can be replaced or rebuilt, only mourned and cherished in memories. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Khartoum.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. We've got some good news for axolotls. Those are adorable little amphibians with feathery gills and cartoonish smiles. The salamanders were once found in lakes and wetlands throughout central Mexico. Now they've largely disappeared, and they are critically endangered. One estimate says fewer than 1,000 adults remain in the wild. But a new study suggests axolotls could have a chance at a comeback. Here to tell us more is Alejandra Ramos. She is the lead author on that study out in the journal PLOS ONE. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so you and your team took 18 axolotls raised in captivity and released them into the wild. What happened?
Well, we were pretty amazed because, first of all, they all survived. Which we were a bit worried about because these axolotls, as you said, they were raised in captivity. And when you have captive animals, they lose a lot of behaviors that they need to survive in the wild. For example, our axolotls had never been exposed to predators. So when you don't have the anti-predatory behaviors, that means that if a snake appears or some sort of predator, then the axolotls might not react. Like, they might not escape or they might not seek refuge, and then they can be more easily predated.
But these axolotls are all thriving, all 18 of them?
Yeah, they all survived. And the ones that we were able to capture after our study finished, they had actually gained weight. So that was a really good result because that means not only are they evading predators, but they're also successfully hunting and finding prey in the wild.
So this is a big discovery that captive-raised axolotls can survive in the wild. Will you tell us a little bit more about why they are so distinct? I mean, people think they're cute, they're adorable. What is it that interests you about them? Why do you think it's important to save this species in particular?
Well, this species is really, really important in Mexico. They're part of our culture. They're part of, like, our history because they were actually living in Lake Xochimilco when the Aztecs were there. Lake Xochimilco is like their native habitat and they're endemic to it. And it's the only place in Mexico where they actually live. So they're really important in that sense. But they're also very important in biomedicine research because this particular species has the abilities to regenerate their gills and their limbs. So they're also really special for biomedicine and for Mexicans. And as you said, they are adorable. So people all over the world just love them.
If axolotls are endangered, at least in part because of pollution or habitat destruction, does releasing them into the wild actually make a long-term difference?
Yes, but only if you restore the habitat where you're going to release them. If you do not make this restoration effort, then they're going to die again. And actually, that's a really sad thing because there's other people that are working with axolotls, and axolotls are really easy to raise in captivity. That's not the problem. But the problem is if these axolotls that you raise in captivity, you release in areas of Xochimilco that have not been restored, then yeah, they're going to die again.
There are many endangered species all over the world. Are there broader takeaways here about how to keep other species from going extinct?
Yes, yes. Thank you for asking this. There are so many species that are struggling, and probably the main problem is habitat loss. So many animals are losing their habitats and their houses all over the world. So this study also shows, like, if you make an effort to restore wetlands or other type of habitats, that you can actually help nature come back. Oh, because another cool thing about our study is that once we restored them for the axolotls, the local people noticed that other species that they hadn't seen in many years started to come back to the area.
That's Alejandra Ramos, a science faculty member at the Autonomous University of Baja California in Mexico. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now to a key ruling in a long contested and closely watched election in North Carolina. A seat on the state Supreme Court held by Democrat Allison Riggs was challenged by Republican Jefferson Griffin last November. Griffin came up short when the votes were counted, and he has been questioning thousands of the early and absentee ballots. Well, last night, a federal judge ruled in favor of the Democrat, telling the state to certify her win. We're joined now by Rusty Jacobs of WUNC. Hi, Rusty.
Hi.
Okay, so it's been, what, 6 months since the election back in November? Can you just catch us up? How did we get to this point?
Right. And as you already noted, Griffin even held a slight lead on election night, but it was a very tight race, not a surprise in a battleground purple state like North Carolina. But in the ensuing days of the election, when the tally is made official, that's when final provisional absentee ballots are validated and tallied, Riggs overtook Griffin and opened a 734-vote lead. Now, that lead was confirmed by multiple recounts. And when the outcome seemed clear, Griffin filed these protests and over more than 65,000 ballots alleging irregularities. And as the case bounced back and forth between state and federal courts and became the last uncertified statewide race in the nation, it has drawn lots of attention, especially from civil and voting rights advocates who've expressed real fears that what Griffin was doing was actually testing a blueprint for overturning legitimate elections, not just in North Carolina, but in future elections across the country.
Okay, and we should know that people were notified, right, if their ballots were being challenged. So they were identified. Can you just tell us about some of these voters and what kind of technicalities that Griffin was challenging here?
So Griffin challenged more than 60,000 ballots, alleging that the voting registration records for these challenged voters had discrepancies that were disqualifying, things like missing a driver's license number or last four digits of their social security number, even though case law and state law are clear that these are not disqualifying situations for people, that they can still vote even if there are questions over registration. He challenged another pool, more than 5,000 voters, military and overseas absentee voters. He challenged their ballots, the ones cast just in four democratically leaning counties, because these voters did not present photo ID, even though state and federal law exempt them from doing so. And so it was a wide net that swept up a lot of voters, including his opponent's parents. Another challenged voter was a WUNC editor I work with every day. I know has a long record of being eligible to vote in North Carolina. And it included Rebecca Lobach, who was the Army Black Hawk helicopter pilot that died in the mid-air collision near Reagan National Airport.
Right. Well, can you tell us more about what this federal judge said in the ruling yesterday?
Judge Richard Myers was appointed during the first Trump term. He was a former UNC law professor, UNC Chapel Hill, and he made it clear that he was not trying to interfere with the ability of North Carolina courts to interpret state laws, especially as they pertain to future elections.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't rewrite rules to an election after ballots have been cast, especially by targeted voters who complied with those rules, because that would violate constitutional rights to equal protection, due process, and fair elections.
Okay. So is this battle finally over, you think?
We're really not sure. The judge gave Jefferson Griffin 7 days to decide whether to file an appeal, so he can either do that or concede.
That is WUNC's Rusty Jacobs. Thank you, Rusty.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
The conclave begins on Wednesday, but it may be a while before a new pope is elected. Over 100 cardinals have gathered in the Vatican to vote on the new pope. The process could take days, but the cardinals are determined to get it done.
We believe that God will act among us and we will have the Holy Father he wants us to have.
We'll have everything you need to know about the conclave tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Pope Francis helped make the Catholic Church more open to the LGBTQ community.
How might the relationship between the community and the church evolve under a new pope?
They really are looking for someone who is holy, someone who's a good evangelizer, and someone who's a good administrator. And frankly, those three things are hard to find in one person.
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. After meeting with President Trump in the Oval Office this afternoon, Canada's newly elected prime minister says they agreed to further trade talks but showed no sign of retreating from their trade war that's shattered decades of trust between the two countries. Prime Minister Mark Carney also made it clear today that Canada will not become the 51st state of the U.S., and he told Trump it's not for sale either.
As you know from real estate, there are some places that are never for sale.
That's true.
We're sitting in one right now, you know, Buckingham Palace, that you visited as well.
That's true.
Having met with the owners of Canada over the course of the campaign last several months, it's not for sale, won't be for sale.
Shortly before Carney's arrival, President Trump posted on social media today that the U.S. doesn't need, quote, anything from its northern neighbor and longtime trading partner. President is calling for the Department of Justice to help free a former Colorado elections clerk incarcerated for tampering with the county's voting equipment from Colorado Public Radio. Benta Berkland has more.
Former Mesa County clerk Tina Peters was sentenced to 9 years after a jury found her guilty of allowing an unauthorized person to secretly access her county's Dominion voting equipment in search of voter fraud. In a social media post, Trump said Peters is an innocent political prisoner being horribly and unjustly punished. He directed the DOJ to take action to help secure her release and said Colorado Democrats were holding her hostage for political reasons. Colorado's officials have already pushed back against the DOJ's attempts to review the case. They say any allegations Peters' prosecution or sentence were politically motivated are baseless. For NPR News, I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
This is NPR. In New York, Lincoln Center Theater announced it would open its season in September with a revival of the epic musical Ragtime. Jeff London reports it will be the first production under a new director.
Lear DeBessonet takes over as artistic director of the Lincoln Center Theater with a restaging of her production of Ragtime, which was a hit in a limited run at New York City Center.
The people call it Ragtime!
The show, which won several Tony Awards after it premiered in 1998, is an adaptation of E.L. Doctorow's audacious novel set in the early 20th century. It tells the story of upper-middle-class white suburbanites, African-Americans in Harlem, and Jewish immigrants, weaving fictional characters with real-life figures. DeBessonet has had two other City Center revivals transferred to Broadway, Into the Woods and Once Upon a Mattress. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
DoorDash reported record first quarter earnings today, announcing a pair of acquisitions as well to boost its delivery service. Orders to the San Francisco-based DoorDash jumped 18%, even as consumers reported feeling uneasy about the economy over the past few months. DoorDash has acquired the food delivery service Deliveroo for $3.5 billion, along with the Seven Rooms, a New York company that makes hospitality management software. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Rome, where on the eve of the papal conclave, one of the big questions hanging in the air is whether the church will continue the path that Pope Francis set in softening its harsh positions on LGBTQ Catholics. Reverend James Martin has spent much of his career ministering to and advocating for this community. It's a ministry Pope Francis personally encouraged.
Thanks for meeting us.
Of course. Let's see if we can get a space in here.
We met Father Martin at the Jesuit Global Headquarters, where he is staying for the conclave. He took us up to the roof, which opens up to a lush hillside Mediterranean garden.
This was Nero's wife's palace or something.
And overlooks the square and St. Peter's Basilica.
Well, let me show you the view. Oh, look, they have the curtains up already. That's so cool.
Oh, yeah, those weren't up yesterday.
The ornate balcony where the next pope will first appear has been draped in red velvet curtains. It was overlooking that historic and symbolic setting where I asked him about what might happen next.
We're at that moment where the cardinals have not gone into the conclave yet. They're meeting every day. There's a lot of buzz around the city. Have you heard stray thoughts one way or another that give you a sense of kind of where that conversation is going among the people that matter?
Well, exactly what we were saying before, that they're thinking about the legacy of Pope Francis. Do they want someone sort of in his vein? Do they want someone who might be a little more sort of sedate, right? Bland, maybe even kind of an administrator. And what I've been hearing also is a surprising amount of cardinals being pretty blunt about their critiques of Pope Francis and also their critiques of Pope Francis. So I think it's, which is good. They really are looking for someone who is holy, someone who's a good evangelizer, and someone who's a good administrator. And frankly, those three things are hard to find in one person.
We were interviewing people the other day at St. Mary Major, where, of course, Pope Francis's tomb is. And we talked to one person who I thought like really embodies this challenge the church faces. She's somebody who grew up in the church, playing the organ in the church. You could hear her talking about it, that was a fond memory. But she said she's LGBTQ, and she felt increasingly pushed out and pushed out and pushed out. And she said, I don't consider myself Catholic anymore because I felt alienated by this church. And I feel like that story plays out in so many places right now, and it's just been this incredible challenge for the church, and I know it's one that you've thought a lot about.
Yeah, there are a lot of people that feel that way. By the same token, there are a lot of people that feel under Francis they've had this experience of welcome. I would say Francis probably did more for LGBTQ people, well, not probably, than all of his predecessors combined, right? The first pope ever to use the word gay, came out against the criminalization of homosexuality. He met with LGBTQ people. He met with me and other people who ministered to them. So I think there is still this sense of alienation, but I think it really diminished under Francis.
I've heard you talk about this over the past few weeks. I've seen you write about it. How do you think of his lasting legacy when it comes to this? Because there were so many gestures and statements that were welcoming, but then there's critics who say, well, when you look at the formal teachings, when you look at the writings, the rule setting, not much did change.
Well, I think the approach changed, and that's a kind of teaching itself. So his change in the conversation, the way he treated LGBTQ people. But actually, he did change some things. So the ability to bless same-sex couples, I mean, that's a change. The decriminalization of homosexuality, that's a change. One thing I want to say is that I think the media tended to overlook. In the last few years of his life, he used to meet regularly with transgender people. It was kind of under the radar, but that's a big deal. I mean, and at his entombment, you could say, at St. Mary Major, there was a representative from the transgender community officially there, you know, at the invitation of a Vatican. So that's a change, and that would not have happened before Francis.
You mentioned the blessing of same-sex couples, though. That, of course, quickly became a non-starter in Africa due to pretty swift measures by African cardinals. And I think that gets to this tension point in the church. And I'm curious what you think the path forward is, that when you look at the parts of the world where the church is most rapidly growing, there's real resistance to things like that from parishioners, from leaders, including from some cardinals who could be in contention to be the next pope. How do you think the church moves forward keeping those views in mind, but also being welcoming, not being, frankly, some people would say at times hateful toward people who are gay.
Right, and it is a breaking point. I think by balancing the tension between what you might call prophecy and unity. Unity is a value in the church. We don't want to split the church over any issue. By the same token, we have to stand up for people who are being marginalized. I always say there were two trends in the church in the last 12 years for LGBTQ people. One was Pope Francis, right? And that trend is over in terms of his gestures and who he appointed as cardinals. The other trend, though, is as more and more people come out, right, and more and more Catholics come out, their families are changed, their parishes are changed, priests are changed, bishops are changed, and that trend is not going to stop. People are going to continue to come out. So it is a frustration that there are many places where cardinals and bishops are pretty homophobic and pretty, I would say, sometimes mean to LGBTQ people. And I think that really has to change. The only way that's going to change, frankly, for these church leaders is encounter. This is one of the reasons Pope Francis was so big on the culture of encounter. It's coming to know people. That's basically it.
You've written a lot of books. You're one of the most prominent priests in the United States. Why did you decide that this was something that you wanted to focus on and really create a ministry reaching out to LGBTQ people?
Well, it's funny. I didn't really decide it. I didn't get up one morning and say, I want to do this super controversial ministry. In fact, I don't like controversy. After the Pulse nightclub massacre in 2016, when 49 people were killed in a gay nightclub, I just saw the bishop's response, in my own opinion, as pretty tepid. And I thought, boy, you know, what does this community have to do to get the attention of the church? Is it not enough that they're murdered? So I gave a talk and then wrote a book called Building a Bridge, and that led into this ministry. So I didn't really get up and decide one day to do this. It just sort of happened. But at each turning point, I think it's important for me to say, I sought approval from my Jesuit superiors, and then eventually met with the Pope, who said in 2019, I want you to continue this ministry in peace. And so that's what I've tried to do.
In this moment where we don't know who the next Pope will be, a lot of people who deeply appreciated that approach that Pope Francis took are worried that the next Pope will not be like that. We'll reverse course on so many things. You wrote an article. The headline was something along the lines of, don't fear the outcome of the next conclave, addressed to people who are worried. What did you say?
Well, I can only approach that from a spiritual point of view, which is to remind people that the Holy Spirit is not exactly, you know, picking the Pope, but he's guiding the process. And then we have to trust that the cardinals are opening themselves up to the activity of the Holy Spirit and really are trying to find the man who they think is the best. And look, these are very prayerful people. They've spent their whole life in service to the church, in service to Jesus, and they want the best. They want the best guy. It may seem political, but we really have to trust in the process. And, you know, as a Jesuit, you know, we will work with whoever steps out on that balcony in a couple of days.
Father James Martin, SJ, thank you so much for talking to us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Since the start of this year, oil prices have dropped by nearly a quarter. Earlier this week, they hit a four-year low. Now, cheaper crude can help keep gasoline prices low, but on the flip side, it's unwelcome news for U.S. oil companies. NPR's Camila Domonoski is here to explain. Hi, Camila.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so tell us why oil prices are dropping now in particular.
One big factor is tariffs. There's concern that the tariffs are going to hurt the global economy and drive down demand for oil. Because when people have less money, there's less driving, less flying, less shipping, less building. Overall, the world just buys less oil. And when people buy less, the prices go down.
Right.
And then at the same time, you've had the oil cartel OPEC Plus, an organization of some of the largest oil producing countries in the world, repeatedly announced that they're going to make more oil. And so that too has driven the price down. In fact, the price has now gone underneath this key threshold that means here in the U.S., it's no longer profitable for most oil companies to drill new wells.
Wait a minute. If tariffs might mean less demand for oil, why is OPEC Plus making more oil then?
Yeah, well, first of all, the fears of a recession are around, but an actual recession hasn't happened yet, right? So OPEC Plus says, look, people want our oil in the here and now. That's what the press releases emphasize, at least. But there may be something else going on. OPEC Plus is a group of a bunch of different countries, right? Saudi Arabia and Russia, most notably. And the whole deal is that everyone in the group agrees to produce less than they could, which keeps oil prices high, and higher oil prices help these countries out. And the whole thing only works if everyone sticks to their quotas. And data shows that lately not everyone has been, especially Kazakhstan and Iraq. And this is a very common source of tension within OPEC. Boosting production right now could be a way for the group to put pressure on those countries, basically saying, oh, you want to make more oil? Why don't we all make more oil and send the price down and see how you like that, right? I will also note President Trump has directly asked these countries to produce more oil, specifically in order to bring prices down. Energy costs are a huge priority for him. It's not clear how much that might be a factor in these decisions.
Okay, so what do lower oil prices mean for everyday people day to day?
Yeah, more money in pockets, right? Gasoline prices typically go up this time of year in the spring, but they went down in April. And with cheaper crude prices, they could go down more. We might actually see the national average drop back below $3 a gallon. That's possible. Lower oil prices also cut prices on goods generally of all kinds because it takes fuel to ship them around. So it just makes things cheaper than they would be otherwise.
Okay, this all sounds great, but I imagine there's a downside.
It is a serious hit to U.S. oil companies, which affects the wider economy because the U.S. is now the world's biggest oil producer. Producers here obviously aren't in OPEC, but they feel the effects of OPEC's decisions. And the U.S. oil price being under $60 a barrel right now means most American producers can't drill those new wells at a profit. That's according to survey data from the Dallas Fed. And that hurts jobs and communities in states like Texas. It's the opposite of Trump's drill, baby, drill vision. And this is a tension that's been at the heart of his energy policy all along. The low prices he's promised consumers and the boom he promised oil companies are simply incompatible.
That is NPR's Camila Domonoske. Thank you so much, Camila.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The second largest department in the U.S. government after the Pentagon is Veterans Affairs. About 470,000 doctors, nurses, therapists, and benefits claims experts work at more than 1,300 sites across the country. As part of the DOGE initiative, the Trump administration aims to cut about 15% of that staff. For the first time today, the VA Secretary Doug Collins appeared on Capitol Hill to answer questions about how he intends to do that without hurting VA health care or benefits. NPR Veterans correspondent Quill Lawrence is here with more. Hi, Quill.
Hey, Ari.
You've reported that the VA has chronic shortages in frontline health care staff. So what did Secretary Collins say about how he plans to cut staff without making that worse?
Yeah, this hearing got contentious. Collins sat for about 2 hours taking questions from senators about how he would cut as many as 83,000 staff. Democratic senators accused Collins of cutting to fit some arbitrary goal that was imposed by Elon Musk's DOGE initiative. And Collins, in turn, accused the senators of trying to terrify veterans that they're going to lose their health care. Listen to this exchange between Connecticut Democrat Richard Blumenthal and the VA secretary.
I will not let you sit here and scare my veterans and scare my employees, because no one has discussed firing doctors or firing nurses. We have always said that we're going to keep frontline health care.
You've said you are firing 83,000 people. You will be firing physicians, nurses, surgeons, counselors, workers who are frontline.
So did the secretary ever answer the question of who will be fired and how they'll reach that number?
There was a lot of asking and a lot of responding. The senators said that they've been writing to the VA, sending questions in writings about what contracts were going to be cut, who would be let go. Collins said he had answered about 90 written requests, but Blumenthal shot back that some of those letters from VA were so devoid of information that they were, quote, an insult to my intelligence and perhaps yours. Collins said that there's this analysis underway to decide what they're going to cut, but senators pointed out that when the deputy chief medical officer of VA testified in recent weeks, he hadn't been consulted about how these cuts are going to be made. We did glean a little bit of hard data, which has been hard to come by, that in the two rounds of probationary staff who were fired, about 2,400 had been fired earlier this year, and Collins updated the senators that only 1,000 were actually let go because the VA was forced to hire back the rest.
And let's drill down into that. I mean, NPR has reported that even staff from the Veterans Suicide Hotline were cut only to be rehired days later.
Yeah, the VCL, the Veterans Crisis Line, made for another contentious exchange. Senator Tammy Duckworth, who's a combat disabled vet, asked Secretary Collins about key staff who had been fired.
That's why we brought them back, Senator. And I think there's something, though, that we need to also clarify here. And this was clarified not by our senior level, it was clarified by career employees, that no VCL who answers the phone, who talked to our veterans, was let go.
Right, but it's the VCL can't operate without the other people as well, like the supervisors on shift or the people who train the VCL. You are parsing your words.
And Duckworth and other senators on both sides of the aisle pointed out that firing people and then hiring them back does not inspire a lot of confidence that this is a sort of a well-thought-out, considered plan going into effect. Collins again accused the senators of trying to scare veterans that they're going to lose their health and benefits. And we can say veterans are concerned. A recent poll by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America found that 81% of veterans that they polled are worried that recent federal cuts could impact veterans' benefits and health care.
That's NPR's Quill Lawrence, who covers Veterans Affairs. Thank you.
Thanks, Ari.
Two-term Georgia Governor Brian Kemp says he is passing on running for the U.S. Senate in next year's midterm elections. That's a blow to Republicans who spent months courting him to challenge Democratic Senator John Ossoff. WABE's Sam Greenglass reports from Atlanta on what Kemp's decision illustrates about the fight for the Senate in 2026.
All spring, politicians, journalists, and strategists have eagerly awaited Kemp's decision.
Obviously, I have a lot of people reaching out to me. I'm going to try to get a little bit of downtime where I can to kind of think through things, and then we'll keep people posted.
Senate Majority Leader John Thune met with Kemp and his wife last month in Atlanta. Senator Pete Ricketts, a former governor himself, spoke with Kemp several times. Of the states Trump won in 2024, Georgia's the only one with a Democratic senator up for re-election. Republicans see Georgia as their top pickup opportunity and saw Kemp as their strongest candidate.
You can't
hardly name another Republican who took on Trump and won and is still beloved by Republicans. It's absolutely without parallel.
Republican strategist Brian Robinson referring there to 2020 when Kemp rebuffed Trump's plea for help overturning the election result. Trump then backed a primary challenge against the governor, who Kemp trounced. Before the end of the 2024 presidential campaign, the two men reconciled. Democrats hope Trump's second-term actions will boost them in the midterms. Ossoff began his re-election bid last month with strong words about the president.
Georgia will bow to no king.
An Atlanta Journal-Constitution poll last week found Kemp in a dead heat with Ossoff, who led other Republicans polled by a healthy margin.
Ossoff's people are smart. They know that the best player on the field has sidelined himself. I'm envisioning corks popping and loud celebratory yells.
Kemp posted on X this week that running next year was not the right decision for him and his family. Steve Wrigley was chief of staff to the late Georgia Governor Zell Miller, who then went on to the Senate but declined to run for re-election.
He told me once, he said, you know, I just don't have the personality where I want to be here for 20 years in hopes of becoming a subcommittee chairman.
Wrigley was in his garden when I gave him a call.
I'm down to the last four packs of zinnia seeds, and I'm done.
He told me going from powerful chief executive to one of 100 in a polarized, sometimes paralyzed Senate was difficult for his old boss.
I think it was Joe Biden, who was in the Senate at the time, told him, you know, a lot of you governors just have difficulty transitioning into being a senator.
That dynamic is more pronounced today. In Michigan, Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer declined to run for an open Senate seat. Colorado Democratic Senator Michael Bennett is running for governor. And in New Hampshire, Republican Governor Chris Sununu, another top GOP recruit, passed on a run for Senate. Jay Morgan, a veteran of Georgia GOP politics, says Congress has ceded a lot of power to the president.
Trump is just manhandling the Congress right now. The Congress has never been more irrelevant.
In Georgia, the GOP Senate field had been frozen until now. Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger and Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene are among the Republicans not ruling out a run. A few hours after turning down the race, Kemp addressed donors at his annual Sea Island retreat. Morgan says he's among the Kemp supporters disappointed by the decision.
But I don't think anybody can be mad about it, because this guy has been a true workhorse in American politics.
And skipping a run now doesn't mean Kemp's career will end when he leaves office in 2027. Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock is up for re-election in 2028. Also up for grabs that year, the White House. For NPR News, I'm Sam Greenglass in Atlanta.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/...
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.